Today is Friday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Australia looks to cut the number of citizens allowed to return home.
Leader Scott Morrison announced on Friday that the number will be capped at 4,000 people each week.
Plus, the Philippines' largest broadcaster loses its bid for a license. So what's next?
There's a big possibility that ABS-CBN will try to do retrenchment.
And the search for the remains of those killed in America's most violent racial massacre. We'll have those stories and more next. Australia will halve the number of its citizens allowed to return home from overseas each week. Prime Minister Scott Morrison made that announcement on Friday as authorities struggle to contain a COVID-19 outbreak in the country's second most populous city. Reuters' Libby Hogan starts us off.
The country is struggling to contain a coronavirus outbreak in Victoria, its second most populous state. Leader Scott Morrison announced on Friday that the number will be capped at 4,000 people each week.
We also agreed today a reduction in the number of inbound arrivals into Australia across those ports that are able to accept.
Since March, only Australian citizens and permanent residents have been allowed into the country. Up until now, returnees would enter a mandatory 14-day quarantine in hotels paid by state governments. But that will change next week. Returning citizens will be expected to pay the cost themselves, and no flights are permitted to go into Victoria as its capital, Melbourne, went into lockdown this week. Its border with New South Wales, where Sydney is located, was also closed. Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews warned that it may get worse before it gets better.
No one should underestimate how significant, how big a challenge that we all face. It is very significant, and that's why each of us have to play our part.
Melbourne's lockdown for 6 weeks is linked to staff members at hotels housing returned travellers for which quarantine protocols were not strictly followed. Victorian state authorities have announced an investigation into the matter last week. Despite surging numbers of cases in Victoria, Australia has done relatively well in controlling the novel coronavirus so far.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. The world over, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases has surpassed 12.25 million people, with more than 550,000 deaths, according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. The United States reported more than 64,000 cases of the coronavirus on Thursday, a record number, overwhelming intensive care units and hospitals in the country's hard-hit West and South, including the states of Arizona, California, Florida, and Texas. Even though the U.S. has failed to flatten the coronavirus curve, President Donald Trump continues to push for the country's schools to open in the coming weeks. However, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease official, has urged governors to delay their reopening plans to end the surges. Also, two World Health Organization experts are heading to the Chinese capital to lay the groundwork for a larger mission to investigate the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. They will meet with Chinese experts in Beijing to set the scope and terms of reference for a WHO-led international mission aimed at learning how the virus jumped from animals to humans. VOA has expanded global coverage of the pandemic on our website. Britain said on Friday that it was committed to working hard to reach a post-Brexit deal with the European Union, but the EU's chief Brexit negotiator said on Thursday that significant divergences persisted. Nicolas Pineau has more from Paris.
Following discussions in London between members of both negotiating teams, European Union chief negotiator Michel Barnier said on Twitter that significant divergences remain. He added that his team will continue working with patience, respect and determination. Barnier warned EU businesses to step up their planning for a no-deal scenario when Britain leaves the single market at the end of 2020. Little progress is believed to have been made on the long-time sticking points of fisheries and the level playing field arrangements designed to prevent Britain from undercutting the EU's environmental and social policy standards and state aid. A British spokesman said Friday the UK remains committed to working hard to find an early understanding on the principle underlying an agreement out of the intensified talks processed during July, as agreed at the high-level meeting on June 15th. The European Commission stated that there will be changes from 2021 in the trade of goods and services, energy and legal cooperation, travel and tourism, regardless of whether there is a new deal or not. European Commission spokesman Daniel Ferry said meetings will continue next week in Brussels. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Congressional Democrats continue to push for answers on news reports Russia paid bounties to Taliban-linked militants for the death of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Those reports, which President Donald Trump and some Republicans have said are unverified, have highlighted the difficulty of confronting Russia during an election year. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
I also want to make clear the following.
The nation's top defense official on Capitol Hill Thursday telling lawmakers in precise language he had not seen intelligence warning Russia was specifically paying bounties for the death of U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
To the best of my recollection, I have not received a briefing that included the word bounty. If it was a credible report, that's important, a credible corroborated report that had that used those words, certainly it would have been brought to my attention by the chain of command, by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and others for action.
Esper later admitted he had been briefed on Russian payments in intelligence not corroborated by the Department of Defense. The administration has been careful to make these distinctions. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo denied congressional Democrats' request to testify on exactly what the administration knew and how it will respond.
Why has Russia faced no consequences, not even a public rebuke from the Trump administration?
President Trump has tweeted those reports were a hoax, and the White House has claimed the intelligence did not reach the president because it was not fully verified. A justification that has received pushback from intelligence experts.
Even if it was only vaguely clear from the raw intelligence that the Russians might be paying bounties for the killing of American soldiers, that information would have made its way to the highest levels of the United States government, including the president.
Lawmakers have since received briefings on the intelligence, but because of security concerns, have had to be careful responding to questions about its verification.
There are a number of questions here, and some of those questions we know the answer more clearly than others. I personally have no doubt that Russia is attempting to cause us trouble, to reduce U.S. credibility all around the world.
The former top U.S. commander in Afghanistan told lawmakers President Trump's response to Russia should be clear.
We should suspend any troop withdrawals from Germany. These troop withdrawals play into Russian desires to undermine and weaken NATO. If carried out despite these bounties, this will be viewed as a sign of American weakness in the face of Russian threats.
It's not known if U.S. troops died because of the possible bounties. Analysts warn that regardless of the veracity of the reports, Russian leader Vladimir Putin will be carefully watching the U.S. response.
The fact that we even fully agree on this underscores the point that we need to recalibrate our posture towards Russia across the whole spectrum.
A discussion delayed in the United States until the election settles who will occupy the White House next year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
And still to come.
These were victims of this horrific incident. And if we can identify them, we will. But most importantly, we are going to be able to rebury them with honor.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
While spending more time at home during the COVID-19 pandemic, some of us may be indulging in foods that might be comforting, but at the same time aren't necessarily the healthiest either. Researchers at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, released a new study that suggests eating a meal high in saturated fats may thwart our ability to concentrate and focus on tasks at hand. The researchers compared the continuous performance test results of 51 women who ate a meal that was either high in saturated fats or one that was prepared with unsaturated fats. The test measures a person's continued attention, concentration, and reaction time over a 10-minute period. The scientists found those who ate the meal with higher saturated fats scored lower on their tests than the women who ate the one containing healthier fat content. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Philippine lawmakers have voted to reject the license renewal of the country's largest TV network, shutting down a major news provider, which the president had repeatedly threatened over its critical coverage. The House of Representatives Committee on Franchises, which is dominated by President Rodrigo Duterte's political allies, rejected a new 25-year franchise license for ABS-CBN. Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, called the decision a grievous assault on press freedom in the country. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Stanley Gahete in Quezon City, just outside of Manila, via Skype, to learn more about what happened.
Congress Committee on Friday formally rejected the bill granting the application of the ABS-CBN franchise, which restricts the rights of the network to broadcast during the entire presidential term of President Rodrigo Duterte. 85 representatives with 46 regular members and 39 ex-officio members composed the panel in the decision of the legislative franchise. Members participated through video conference, cast their votes through calls or text messages to the committee secretariat as the committee convened in a hybrid session.
With the difficulties facing ABS-CBN moving forward and the likelihood that it will not receive another license before the end of President Rodrigo Duterte's presidential term, what's next for ABS-CBN?
Yeah, these are some of the questions received by ABS-CBN from different media outlets, foreign and local, because so far, as they said, it's the end. It's the dead end for ABS-CBN. Well, for ABS-CBN, I called and talked to the corporate communications of ABS-CBN, and they said that there's a big possibility that ABS-CBN will try to do retrenchment. Because they are losing, as they said, $600,000 per month, and they can't sustain anymore the needs of the workers and its salaries and all. So, they said, they will try to reduce some of the workers by the end of the month. So far, ABS-CBN, since ABS-CBN now venturing to digital, they will, use and maximize the mobile application and all the social media. But not all people in the Philippines are into social media. So they don't have access anymore, even on some channels of ABS-CBN.
Without ABS-CBN broadcasting terrestrially, what does this mean for freedom of the press in the Philippines?
You know, many groups, even media experts and veteran journalists in the Philippines, lambasted the decision because ABS-CBN was singled out in this case. Because there are many TV stations in the Philippines who have expired franchise but still continue airing until now, and even though there are no approved franchise yet. So it's very disappointing to see that ABS-CBN, just because President Rodrigo Duterte expressed his anger before to ABS-CBN and other critical outlets, and even the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines said that the chamber or the Congress has lost all claim to represent the people and their interests, because more than 11,000 people have been stripped of their jobs. Millions of Filipinos have been deprived of their right to know and their right to choose how to access the information they need to decide, especially in times of pandemic, and their futures as well as the entertainment that allows them a respite from the hardships of life.
Stanley Gahete is a journalist from Quezon City in the Philippines. Friday, authorities arrived with a search warrant at the Hong Kong office of independent pollster Robert Chung, more than a week after Beijing imposed its national security law. Chung told Reuters that authorities had arrived at his office and he was trying to understand the basis of the situation. On Thursday, the United States placed sanctions on the highest-ranking Chinese official it's ever targeted over alleged human rights abuses against Uyghur Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. It's a move that is likely to further ratchet up tensions between the two countries. Reuters' Gloria So has the details.
Washington blacklisted Xinjiang's Communist Party Secretary Chen Chuanguo, a member of China's powerful Politburo, and three other officials. Chen is widely considered the senior official responsible for the security crackdown in Xinjiang, where United Nations experts and activists estimate more than a million Muslims have been detained in camps. The highly anticipated sanctions followed months of increasing U.S. hostility towards Beijing over China's handling of the coronavirus outbreak and its tightening grip on Hong Kong. The Chinese embassy in Washington did not respond to a request for comment. But China has denied mistreatment of Uyghur Muslims and says the camps provide vocational training and are needed to fight extremism. The U.S. sanctions were imposed under the Global Magnitsky Act. The act allows the U.S. government to target human rights violators worldwide by freezing any U.S. assets, banning U.S. travel, and prohibiting Americans from doing business with them. Main exile group the World Uyghur Congress welcomed the move and called for the European Union and other countries to follow suit. Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who sponsored legislation signed by President Trump in June calling for sanctions over the repression of Uyghurs, told Reuters the move was, quote, long overdue and that more steps were needed. But despite Trump's hardline public remarks about Beijing, former National Security Advisor John Bolton alleged in his recent book that Trump said Chinese President Xi Jinping should go ahead with building the detention camps in Xinjiang and also sought Xi's help to win re-election. Trump said in an interview last month he had held off on tougher sanctions on China over Uyghur Muslims' human rights due to concerns that such measures would have interfered in trade negotiations with Beijing.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. Beginning next Monday in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the city, along with the University of Oklahoma and the Oklahoma Archaeological Survey, will conduct a test excavation of the city's Oaklawn Cemetery. Researchers with the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Graves Investigation think the site could be where African-American victims from the massacre were buried. The test site was chosen based on oral histories passed down and results from ground-penetrating radar that discovered an anomaly. Scott Ellsworth is a professor in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan and part of the DIG team. I spoke with him via Skype about the project.
So what we'll do is we're gonna take a small area in the middle, about 6 feet by 8 feet. We're going to excavate down, first using a backhoe for the first few feet, and then by hand. And we're going to go down and see if this anomaly, number one, is indeed human remains or not. Then we'll see what condition they're in. I mean, there could be, they could be in great condition, they could be in very poor condition. And then we will see if we can determine whether these human remains are indeed related to the race massacre, whether we have a high degree of confidence that they are. So that is really the goal, you know, coming up here right now. If we do find remains and we are convinced or feel fairly solidly that these are race massacre remains, we will then go ahead and stop at that point. We will cover up the hole and then await approval for the next step.
How big a team are we talking in terms of carrying out this investigation?
Well, that's a great question, and that is, you know, we had originally planned to do this in April, right before the pandemic hit. So our team is smaller, but it's still pretty good size. I would imagine there'll be a dozen of us off and on over the course of the excavation that's within the enclosed area.
And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, Oklahoma has seen a surge in cases as of late. So while you have a smaller number of people participating in the dig, what other precautions are you taking?
Well, quite a few, actually. So I'll be arriving, you know, back home in Tulsa on Sunday night. And the first thing that'll happen when I check into the hotel is that I will be tested for COVID by a member of the Tulsa Fire Department. We will all wear protective gear, PPE. we'll all follow, you know, safe distancing guidelines, all of that. So it's everyone is hyper aware of that. And that's why the number of people allowed inside this area has been very highly controlled and reduced.
Speaking of being able to keep physical distance while carrying out this work, does that inhibit or make things more difficult because you can't get as close to one another while you are researching this area?
I would say, yeah, I think it'll slow us down a bit. No question. It's certainly after we get, you know, for these through these first few 2 or 3 feet that'll be excavated, you know, mechanically. After that, it's going to be people using trowels by hand. So that's going to go slow. But that kind of work is done carefully and slow as well. So, yes, I think we would have more people in the hole under normal circumstances than we will now. But, you know, this is, you know, there's a deep commitment. Nobody's getting paid for this. This is a deep commitment that all of the professionals, the archaeologists, the forensic anthropologists and others, people from the medical examiner's office are there. We consider this to be, you know, almost sacred work, and people are going to do it very carefully anyway.
How important is it to carry out this investigation of the mass graves for the 1921 massacre? Because here we are 99 years later and still not much is known about the event.
Well, it's hugely important. And it's hugely important to remember that these individuals that we think are here, if not, they're elsewhere. These were largely African-American massacre victims that were buried while their loved ones were being held under armed guard at various internment camps during the city. Martial law was declared near the end of the massacre. The National Guard troops came in, and they had a problem. They had a problem with these bodies, what they're going to do with them, but rather to do the humane things, have people come and identify these individuals, these bodies. Instead, they just decided that they were going to bury them. And they weren't going to mark the graves either. They weren't going to tell anyone, you know, where they were. So these are individuals who were all murder victims, by the way, who were literally thrown away. And this is in part for the families, certainly, who lost loved ones to see if they can find out what happened to the remains of their loved ones. But it's also an opportunity for the city of Tulsa and for the nation as a whole, really to welcome these people back, to say these were victims of this horrific incident, and if we can identify them, we will. But most importantly, we are going to be able to rebury them with honor.
Scott Ellsworth is a professor at the University of Michigan and author of Death in the Promised Land, a detailed account of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great weekend.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Phineas Munyarugarama, a former lieutenant colonel in the Rwandan Armed Forces, is wanted for taking part in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. Munyarugarama is accused of organizing and taking part in massacres and rapes of Tutsis in April 1994, and for ordering those under his command, including civilians and Interahamwe militias, to take part. Under his orders, soldiers from the Geko military camp allegedly killed approximately 800 civilians between April 7th and April 15th, 1994. For these and other crimes, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, now known as the Residual Mechanism for International Tribunals, indicted Munyarugarama on charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, and issued a warrant for his arrest. The United States is cooperating with other governments, the United Nations, and the Residual Mechanism to make it harder for Munyarugarama and the others involved in the genocide to continue to elude justice. To achieve that end, the U.S. is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to his arrest. If you or anyone you know has information on Phineas Munyarugarama's activities and whereabouts, you can provide it with complete confidentiality. please visit the nearest U.S. Embassy or Consulate website to contact the Regional Security Office. Email the U.S. War Crimes Rewards Program at wcrp@state.gov or contact us at WhatsApp on 1-202-975-5468. You can also visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/warcrimesrewardsprogram or follow us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/warcrimesreward for photos of the wanted fugitives. All credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.